Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the Lew Church Memorial Lecture in Religion and Economics. Gerard Casey is a professor of philosophy in the School of Philosophy at University College Dublin, adjunct professor of the Maryville Institute, Birmingham, UK, and an adjunct scholar here at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. He received his BA from University College Cork, then went on to receive an MA and PhD from the University of Notre Dame. He also has a Bachelor of Law, a Bachelor of Laws from the University of London and a Master of Laws from University College Dublin. Some of his more recent and notable publications are as follows. He has a book due out in May 2010 on Murray Rothbard, which is the volume 15 of Major Conservative and Libertarian Thinkers, out from Continuum Press. He has also published in 2010 Legal Polycentrism in the Journal of Libertarian Studies, Economic Liberalism and Social Justice, Economic Affairs with Jay Meadowcroft, and Constitutions of No Authority, Spoonerian Reflections. His ASC presentation from 2009, which is The Master, The Indefensibility of Political Representation, has come out in Philosophical Inquiry. So without further ado, help me welcome Professor Gerard Casey.
So I'd like to begin by thanking the Mises Institute for the invitation to deliver this Lew Church Lecture in Religion and Economics. It's really very gratifying to be asked to speak to such a congenial group of like-minded people as my academic mentor, the late Ralph McInerney, recently deceased, said once about the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, it's nice to be part of a group where you don't always have to begin from scratch. Okay. So I feel like that about the ASC. And though there is no party line to which everyone has to adhere here, indeed the differences of opinion at this conference are both instructive and entertaining. The palpable and sort of red-blooded commitment of all the speakers in attendance to liberty is refreshing and exhilarating. After 3 days of this conference, I attain a kind of natural non-chemical high, so much so that one of these days I'm going to attract the unwelcome attentions of the authorities as I go through. Now, the bad news. The bad news is that there are no pictures. Okay, so sorry about that. The title is wrong. So the title was for another paper, which I haven't written, and this paper doesn't have a title. So we have a slight mismatch and so on. And there are remarkably few jokes. The reason for that is you can blame David Gordon. So on two trips to the Atlanta airport from here, I was outgunned on the joke department, and so I've given up. Okay, he's the clear winner on the joke front. Okay, I surrender. Okay, David. Now, unlike the previous talks I've given at this conference, there's no knockdown, drag-out argument here. This talk is meant to be tentative and exploratory, and I'm going to leave as much time as I can at the end for questions and for discussions. In fact, I feel a little bit confessional. It's almost like I'm sort of at an AA meeting. You know, my name is Gerard Casey, and I'm an Austrian. You know, in Irish polite circles, there's a rule which is that you're not allowed to talk about religion, politics, and sex, which means that there's some awful long girls at dinner parties. What's there to talk about? But anyway, so I'm going to range over a number of topics. Did I say something about not telling jokes? I better stay with it. I'm going to range over a number of loosely related, connected topics and open up some themes for discussion. Now, the first thing I'd like to point out, with all due modesty, is that I'm superbly qualified to talk about the issue of religion and economics. My wife always says to me, by the way, don't use irony. Nobody ever understands it. So that was ironic. First of all, the reason is, as an ex-atheist who's a bad Catholic, and I should say, by the way, that all Catholics are bad Catholics. That's sort of the nature of the beast. If as a Catholic you ever hear yourself described as devout, you know you're in serious trouble. So that's my first reason. That's my first quality. The second one is that I've had no training, formal training in economics. What little I know being gleaned from my conversion, and I use the term conversion advisedly, to Austrianism some 5 or 6 years ago. A conversion occurs when material that was once organized by one paradigm is suddenly and to some extent inexplicably reorganized by another, All the same data is there, all the same facts. What's different is the significance of those facts. There's a discontinuity, oftentimes radical, between the two paradigms, the old one and the new. And nevertheless, the new paradigm is, to use the computer term, backwards compatible. Now, I was converted to Catholicism when I was about 30. I won't bore you with the shocking details. You have to wait till my autobiography comes out in paperback. That was ironic as well. But in brief, the conversion was the result of a process in which the previously dominant paradigm, a sort of very non-militant, laid-back, almost comatose, almost Californian, secularism, had been undermined by a combination of personal circumstances, knowledge, changed behavior, and personal influence, which conspire to produce a particular outcome in which one and only one pattern made sense of all the data. A bit like C.S. Lewis, I found myself very surprised and not at all pleased to be Catholic, but there we are. It really sort of crabs your lifestyle, so I could say, but anyway. So many years later, I underwent a similar experience in respect of economics. For most of my life, I regarded economics as a sort of mildly esoteric, if largely harmless activity. I was broad-minded. I wasn't that way inclined myself, but as so long as they didn't frighten the horses, I was prepared to tolerate these arcane activities in others. And a friend of mine went to Germany on a sabbatical. Now, he knew I was interested in money, not just the perennial fact that I never seemed to have enough of it, but in the very notion itself. And he brought me back, little did he know what he was starting, he brought me back a copy of Mises' Theory of Money and Credit. Now, if you had to advise somebody where they were going to start, all right, this is not the place. Now, I don't have to tell you, right, that this book is not exactly an airport novel, readable in one sort of large gulp. Most people presented with this work as their introduction to economics would have had a sort of minor heart attack. The effect on me, however, was mildly electric. Here, for the first time, was an explanation of the phenomenon of the money, which not only made sense to me, not that it explained why I didn't have enough of it myself, but which made sense to me, but which had a ring of necessity to it, not merely plausible, but convincing. I quickly acquired most of Mises' other works and started to read Human Action. Now, if the effect of Theory of Money and Credit was mildly electric, the effect of reading Human Action was like being strapped into the electric chair and receiving 25,000 volts. I got so excited reading this book, particularly the methodological section, the one that sends most people to sleep, right, up to page 142, I even remember the page, that I sometimes had to put the book down and walk around the room to cool off. Now, most books that produce that effect on people have a different content. Okay. I don't read those books. Not since the age of 30, anyway. Now, while at a distance of some years, the first fine kind of careless rapture has diminished somewhat, I still get a frisson of excitement every time I read this material. Seriously. Okay, if I want to sort of brighten up a dull February afternoon, I just pick up that book and read that stuff. 5 or 10 pages, the book goes down, I have to walk around the room. It's great. Now, here was an account of Human Action, which at once gelled with what I knew from the philosophical tradition to be broadly correct. And that was one of the most exciting parts of it for me. In other words, the way in which it dovetailed with what I learned from Aristotle and from Aquinas. It was really exciting. But an account which went beyond the tradition to open up to theoretical consideration a realm of knowledge which I had simply assumed to be at best open to historical treatment. Here was another paradigm which provided a framework into which whole swathes of material could be fitted and which provided a basis for opening up new questions and new lines of inquiry. I have to tell you, I mean, I'm sure it's the experience of most people involved in academia here that you reach a stage in your teaching where you thought, didn't I say that last year? 5 years ago? 10 years, God, my brain has stopped working. One of the reasons I did some law degree some years ago was just to make sure that my brain was in fact still functioning. I'm still not sure whether taking a law degree was the right way to find that out, but nevertheless. Okay. Now let me turn to the question of religion here. Without perhaps ever explicitly realizing the fact, we tend to assume that religion by its very nature has something to do with God and moreover with a God who has a certain relationship with the universe. And while the religions that we in the West know best, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all follow this pattern, not every system of belief that is commonly recognized as a religion, in fact, does. Confucianism, for example, has at best a shadowy conception of a transcendent realm, which he calls Tian, as in Tiananmen Square. And by the way, Confucius advises us, I like Confucius, he says, have as little as possible to do with this realm. Okay, don't mess with it. And Buddhism seems to have no conception of anything at all resembling a theistic god. Hinduism, of course, has many gods, perhaps too many, several million, in fact, which seems to me to be overdoing it slightly. But only in certain versions does it resemble the theism with which we are familiar. Religion, then, is not necessarily concerned with God or with an afterlife, but with the ultimate source and ground of meaning. Robert Nelson, in his book called The New Holy Wars, Economic Religion versus Environmental Religion, from which I'm plagiarizing shamelessly in part, so I won't tell you which, because you think the good bits are mine, okay, says the following. A religion does not necessarily have to involve the existence of a transcendent God outside this world. Most people have a set of fundamental beliefs that both explains the place of human beings in the world and guides their lives, and the intellectual articulation of these beliefs in a formal way becomes a theology. And he refers to a definition of religion given by Max Stackhouse as, quote, a comprehensive worldview or metaphysical moral vision that is accepted as binding because it is held to be in itself basically true and just, even if all dimensions of it cannot be either finally confirmed or refuted. So then, religions don't necessarily involve a conception of God, but they provide overarching schemas of meaningfulness and significance within which one can locate one's own particular and limited experiences. They provide, in effect, a system of ultimate values, of ultimate explanatory concepts, which enable one to make sense of one's experience and one's environment. And so some things that don't look like religions on the face of it turn out to be religions. All right, now I want to bear that in mind, because that definition of religion, and it's not unarguable, is going to be important for what I have to say. Let me just shift gears slightly before I come back to my main point. There are many perfectly respectable modes of human inquiry. History, economics, psychology, physics, chemistry, biology. And all such inquiries have both a formal and a material object. That is, they study some range of phenomena under a particular description. Now, while the human sciences, the Geisteswissenschaften, all take man as their material object of study, they differ from one another in their formal approaches. So history studies human actions under its own specific formality, psychology likewise, and so on with the other disciplines. And while there may be border disputes between various disciplines, say, for example, it's between physical chemistry and chemistry, generally doesn't lead to sort of fights, but there can be border disputes, for the most part, each discipline is reasonably clearly circumscribed, and so they can coexist peacefully. Here as elsewhere, good fences make good neighbors. I don't know if good neighbors make good fences, but certainly it operates the other way around. Each mode of inquiry is intrinsically circumscribed both by its material and by its formal object. If a chemist, for example, starts measuring the reaction times, not of chemical substances, but of the experimenters in his lab, then he's no longer doing chemistry. He's doing psychology. It's important to realize this. Now, disciplines tend to have imperialistic tendencies that sometimes find expression in sort of lust for expansion, that kind of desire for Lebensraum. So it's been said that to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And as father of three engineers, I tend to believe that engineers tend to perceive the world as a set of problems requiring technical solutions. Okay. And likewise for other practices. You know the way when you buy a car, okay? The roads are full of that model. You go, suddenly there are millions of them out there. You see them everywhere. Okay. Similarly, when you have your own particular discipline, everything, you know, seems to be, beware of going to a doctor who specializes in a particular disease. You may have that disease. Lots of people tend to have that. Anyway, so when a particular discipline aspires to universal domination, it ceases to be that discipline. It has given up any claim to empirical grounding, and it has become, in fact, an ersatz religion in the sense in which I've sketched above. Thus, history can become historicism. Evolution can evolve in the hands of the dreaded D's, Dawkins and Denner, for example, into evolutionism. By the way, you should see Jerry Fodor's latest book on this, What Darwin Got Wrong. If you haven't read it, read it. It's a good read. Psychology turns into psychologism and science into scientism. Similarly, economics can become economism. And the study of our environment can become, and here I coin a term of art, I would normally use environmentalism, but I want to coin a term of art for the, if you like, universal expansion of the legitimate study of environment. I'm going to call it environmentism, just for the sake of this paper. Now, we might regard these developments as forms of intellectual cancer, in which a proper part of the whole aspires to become the whole and so abandons its natural limitation. That's what happens to real cancer. Some cells get above themselves and want to take over the whole body. It's really bad for you. Okay. Now, if there is one thing I do believe, it is that all truths are co-possible. Despite this, it is still possible for one to experience certain elements of cognitive dissonance in one's epistemic commitments, and this is a spur to further inquiry. So many of the topics that are dealt with in discussions of religion and economics have to do with areas of possible overlap in which it appears that one's religion dictates X when one's economics dictates not X. If you subscribe, as I do, to an authoritative, if you don't believe in an authoritarian, authoritative religion, this can be a particular problem. Okay, if your commitments are to religion that is historically tends to be marked by resistance and revolution, then you probably have more scope. So I'm not saying these areas are only problems for Catholics, but Catholics seem to experience them in a particular way. Sometimes the overlap can be represented then, if you like, as an overlap between religion on top and then economics underneath, or sometimes in a sort of tripartite between religion, economic, ethics, sort of more or less on the same level, and then economics underneath, sort of vertical relationship. Now, much good and definitive work has been done along these lines, not least by Dr. Thomas Woods in his superlative book, The Church and the Market. Again, if you haven't read it, do. If better still, buy it and read it. The book is downstairs. I saw it. Well, so do that. I get a kickback from Tom, right? I don't, actually. The history of the 20th century is in part a history of the rise and fall of a variety of secular, or what I'm going to call intramundane religions, Marxism, fascism, National Socialism, Freudianism, secular humanism, evolutionism, and the latest fashionable intramundane religion called environmentism. I'm going to look at this in a bit more detail. So I'm going to look at economism and environmentism, where economism is the standard neo-orthodox school understood as the ideological wing of the progressive political movement. Okay. And environmentalism is the elevation of environmental issues to the status of unchallengeable religious dogma. It's important to note in this context that the relationship between religion and economism and religion and environmentalism, and religion here now used in the sort of standard way in which we use it, is not the vertical relationship I've talked about earlier, but a horizontal relation between competing religious frameworks. Right? So it's not one over the other, but they're all now starting out, if you hear, on the same level, because they're all making the same claims to universal domination. Despite the emergence and the burgeoning of the intramundane religions, it's, I think, interesting to realize that even in a rapidly expanding post-Christian world, our thoughts and experiences are still shaped by our Christian past, so much so that we are hugely influenced by it, even though largely unaware of this continuing shaping. Again, as Robert Nelson just mentioned, puts it, economic and environmental religions are secularizations of the core messages of Christianity. Unquote. The power of potential civic religions such as feminism or left Puritanism, nowadays the dominant civic religion is, as I said, the not-so-jolly green giant, is that they claim to be tolerant while being every bit as totalitarian and oppressive as any of more traditional religions has ever been, assuming that to be correct, for the sake of the argument. Rothbard, interestingly too, believed that society must of necessity have some overarching set of constitutive beliefs. If it is not one set, it will be another. He said, some religion is going to be dominant in every society. If Christianity, for example, is scorned and tossed out, some horrendous form of religion is going to take its place, whether it be communism, New Age occultism, feminism, or left Puritanism. I have to tell a joke. Okay, a man is walking down the street of Belfast late at night, and he feels a gun pressed to the back of his head, and the voice goes, Catholic or Protestant? And he thinks rapidly, and he goes, atheist. And there's a moment's baffled silence, and then the voice goes, Catholic atheist or Protestant atheist? Shouldn't laugh at your own jokes. To illustrate my point, I've constructed a table here, which is incomplete, by the way, and you can take this as an exercise to fill in some of the blanks, which lists some of the central concepts of a theistic religion, this time Christianity, but I could have taken other ones, but it's the one I know best, and then locates, in part at least, the equivalent concepts in economism and environmentalism. So, let's take the central notion of God in Christianity. For me, and the corresponding notion in environmentalism is, well, nature, or the planet, described in Earth First, for example, as Earth is the goddess and the proper object of human worship. What would it be for economism? The answer is, well, the government. Okay. Sin. Well, for environmentalism, it's consumption or pollution. Okay. For economists, it's scarcity. Punishment. Environmental disaster. Global warming. Inflation. Recession. Salvation. Sustainability. Economic progress. Original sin. Now, there's an interesting one. Agriculture. The agricultural revolution of 10,000 years ago. That was a bad move. That leads to alienation from nature. And then even worse things like the Industrial Revolution. On this side, poverty. Eden, the Garden of Eden. Harmony with nature, disturbed by agriculture, not the serpent. Okay? I don't know what to put in over here on the Hellenism side, so you figure that one out. Heaven. Oh, that's a nice one. Well, restored nature, unspoiled nature, the abolition of scarcity. Churches and cathedrals. Wilderness, untouched areas. Banks. The Bible. I don't know what to put over here. Right? Samuelson's Economics. Already getting honorable mention earlier today. The priesthood or the Pope? Well, I don't know who to put in for the priesthood over here on the environmentalism side, but certainly Al Gore gets the Pope. Right? There's no question about that. And economists at large, okay, constitute the priesthood over on this side. Latin as a hieratic language, well, I don't know what to put over here, maybe gobbledygook. Mathematics, clearly, and so on. Indulgences, oh, this is a nice one. I don't know what to put over here for the economists, right, but carbon offsets go over here. Right, and so on. So you can have a lot of fun with these. So if anyone wants to help me out with the blanks, feel free to do it. We could even construct, I hope nobody will take this in ill part, it's not meant to be blasphemous, but we could even construct a sort of creed for this. Now, I only had time to sort of sketch out the first few words. So here would be the sort of environmentalist creed. You have to do one yourself for the economist creed, and you have to fill in the blanks. So instead of, I believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, of all that is seen and unseen, you get, I believe in the unity of nature, or mother, the all-encompassing, who is heaven and earth. I believe all this is clean and not unclean. Okay, and so on. And you finish off. So the exercise is for you. Now, let me just a few more remarks on this then, just to try and illustrate the point here. Again, I'm not talking about economics operating within its own particular limits, indeed, or even environmentalism working within its own limits, but the extended and expanded form of both. Nelson writes again in his book, and I quote, economic religion for much of the 20th century exalted human control over nature. Environmental religion today offers a precisely opposite view. And he says, the progressive gospel was, quote, there must be a central coordinating intelligence for all of American society, and it would fall to the federal government to fulfill this role. Well, there's a shock and a surprise if ever we heard one. For the environmentalist, again, global warming isn't a technical problem to be solved by appropriate means. It's a sin, right? And sin in religion is non-negotiable, right? You can't say, well, you know, I'll pay prices. Well, you know, what do you need to offset? Sins are not things you can commit. So whenever, I've often discussed, when talking about these things on the radio or discussing them, right, and you say, well, there's ways of solving this, and you have to look, you know, at the cost-benefit and so on. Cost-benefit, schmust benefit. I mean, it's a, you know, global warming is always wrong. No matter what solution you come up with or what you suggest, it's always wrong. It's always a problem. For some radical environmentalists, indeed, human beings are a blight on the face of the earth. So David Foreman thinks we're cancer. And Paul Watson, the AIDS of the earth. Right? And while these are extreme opinions, I suggest that many environmentalists in the radical sense in which I'm talking about them have similar sort of views. In fact, environmentalism is probably the last kind of acceptable mode of racism, because it turns out that there are too many people. And when you press people on that, they always turn out to be too many of the wrong kinds of people. Although in polite society, you would never say what those are, but they're not us. Okay, I'll leave it to you to figure it out. Okay. I noticed, by the way, that I was up at 5 o'clock this morning because I couldn't sleep. Well, I slept from 6 last night till 5, and then I was awake, so I worked on this paper. And one of the reasons I'm more incoherent than normal is, A, I'm sleep-deprived, and B, I've written all over this paper, and I can't read it properly. But I noticed that reading USA Today, they regard, Professor Michael Mann, okay, they report, by the way, without a trace of irony, that Professor Michael Mann, one of the people at the center of the so-called ClimateGate scandal, is being investigated by his university, Penn State, to determine whether his actions, quote-unquote, undermine faith in the science of climate change. I couldn't believe that when I read it at 5 o'clock this morning. I thought, there is a God. Thank you. Okay, it fell right into my lap. Okay, okay, where are we? Oh, yeah. Now, I want to talk about, okay, so in the way they've seen, religion understood in the expanded sense in which I'm talking about it, and environmentism and economism in the sense in which they are religions, are all working, if you like, on the same plane, jostling each other for positions. Now, there's a strategy here, which is the sort of strategy of positioning yourself in the sort of naked public square, where you portray yourself in your own position as being perfectly clean, and everybody else, if you like, is having dirty hands. And I want to show you how this works in this area. So there's a powerful incentive for each of the secular religions to position themselves as uncontroversial factual positions, when in fact they're imbued with a whole raft of normative and metaphysical assumptions. And Nelson agrees. He talks about, quote, the powerful normative assumptions and the processes of theological reasoning that underlie the thinking of economists and environmentalists alike. Traditional religions, on the other hand, we are told, must be quarantined, kept well away from polite society, but our secular religions are neutral, uncontaminated by value preferences, and so everyone can be forced to practice them. And of course, the agents of diffusion are the schools. That's how it works. The problems, then, with religious disputes is that they involve disagreement about fundamentals. The rules of engagement, the description of the problem, the efficacy of solutions, all these are disputed matters. Nothing can be taken for granted. It's a clash of worldviews, or to use the philosopher R.J. Collingwood's term, clash of absolute presuppositions. And so the sort of non-religion versus religion strategy, in other words, what you've got is religion, but mine is just an ordinary factual position, is in fact a version of the no position position. It's a rhetorical attempt to win the argument before the argument even starts. In fact, on this level, it's one religion against another, so there cannot be a neutral position. No one can claim neutrality. Now, many slight change of gear here, and sorry for the incoherence. This is probably down to my mental confusion rather than simply tiredness. Many traditional heresies involve an attempt to eliminate the distinction between the human and the divine, to make gods of men or to make gods of the natural world, as indeed did the pagan religions against which Judaism and Christianity contended. What we see in environmentalism is a return to paganism, where God or the gods are immanent in or identified with aspects of the natural world. Now, to see nature as God is very different from seeing nature as evidencing or showing forth the glory of God. Celtic Christianity, for example, had a genius for reading nature as evidencing the glory of God. The early Irish monks often saw the glory of God reflected in the beauty of nature, a view captured in an early 20th century poem by Joseph Plunkett. I see his blood upon the rose, and in the stars the glory of his eyes. His body gleams amid eternal snows, his tears fall from the skies. I see his face in every flower, the thunder and the singing of the birds are but his voice, and carven by his power, rocks are his written word. All pathways by his feet are worn, his strong heart stirs the ever-beating sea. His crown of thorns is twined with every thorn, his cross is every tree. And though even though that poem was written in the early 20th century by Joseph Plunkett, who, by the way, was shot by firing squad as one of the revolutionaries in 1916, okay, it's very much indicative of a, if you like, a tradition of seeing God in nature. But for these Christians, if traces of God could, as it were, be seen in the world of nature, they were quite clear that nature was not, repeat, not God. This is the genius of the Judeo-Christian, and indeed, subsequently, the Islamic tradition. Nature, whatever it is not God. Now, common to both economism and environmentalism, on the other hand, common indeed to all intramundane religions, is the belief that heaven on earth is possible. This is probably one of the greatest of all heresies. Right? The kingdom of God, if you're a Christian, is not, repeat, not of this world. For economism, it's progress towards a world without scarcity or approaching that world, while for economists, it's a return to Eden, to a world either without man or with a significantly reduced human population. Environmentalism, in the end, then, is a kind of atavistic romanticism, a back to nature, return to Eden, to the myth of the Golden Age. Now, in this final section, I want to again change gears once more. I hope that you'll have many questions and maybe we'll knit up some of these perhaps somewhat diverse themes. I want to talk about the current crisis from the perspective of economics and religion. The current global financial crisis that began in 2008 has been widely touted as evidence of the failure of what the popular press and electronic media like to call unrestrained capitalism. Yes. Writing in Barron's in March 2009, Randall Forsythe noted wryly, quote, "Will capitalism survive?" was the question before the lunch table on Wednesday. "It hasn't been tried," I replied. "Not, at least not since the McKinley administration, and certainly not since 1914, when the Federal Reserve started operations in earnest." And again, I'd like to draw your attention to the fount of all wisdom. What's that paper I was reading again this morning? I've forgotten the name of it now. That shows you how tired I am. USA Today, thank you very much. Again, in USA Today, it's reported without irony, okay, that, quote, two top economists worry that Washington is wasting the financial crisis, squandering a chance to prevent a repeat of Wall Street's 2008 meltdown. Notice, it's not wasting money or resources or your future. It's wasting the crisis. I couldn't believe this again. I thought, there is a God, and he loves me. Thank you for two good quotes from USA Today. Simon Johnson and who else, Joseph Stiglitz, chastised policymakers for believing that, quote, financial markets could police themselves and correct their own excesses. Bring on the state. Anyway, so what the crisis is evidence for, however, is not the failure of capitalism as such, about which one might say, as Gandhi is reported to have said about Western civilization, that it would be a good idea, but the peculiar nature of modern banking. In particular, the incestuous relationship between the commercial investment banks, the central banks such as the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank, and governments, a topic on which Rothbard and other Austrians have written extensively. The immediate solution to the problem is masterly inactivity. Unfortunately, governments are not in the business of doing nothing. And so either failing to recognize or denying that it was their policy interventions and their state-supported central banks that produced the boom-bust cycle in the first place, they feel compelled to intervene again to rescue society from what they fondly imagine to be the excesses of unrestrained capitalism. But leaving to one side the economic inappropriateness of the responses to the financial crisis, what we also witness is the use of the crisis for the legitimation of an ever-increasing range of interventions in the market economy and ever more irksome restrictions on our personal liberties. I had a peculiar experience coming through Atlanta Airport. I had to go through security on the way out. I knew if I raised a question, they were going to strip search me, so I didn't say anything, right? But I couldn't figure that one out. What am I going to smuggle out of the airport that is going to do damage to Atlanta or the USA? I couldn't figure that one out. It's a mystery to me. I still don't know. Anyway, the motto might be, never let a good crisis go to waste. As we saw with Stiglitz, I mean, their criticism of the government is it's letting wasting the crisis. Okay, I can't get over that. As in the case of military and political crises, which though invariably generated by government action, are to be cured by, what else, yet more government action, so too with economic crises. For the critics of capitalism, the problem is market freedom. The solution is tighter regulation and control of the market. In reality, of course, the problem is the unholy trinity of government, banks, and all forms of welfare, whether global, corporate, or individual. The solution is to allow markets to operate with real freedom, not the phantom simulacrum of freedom that they currently enjoy, to require banks to operate in non-bankrupt mode, interest rates to be determined by the demand for and supply of money, preferably real money, and to insist upon the immediate cessation of confiscatory state policies that are used to fund all forms of clientelistic welfare. The Austrian approach to economics, of which Rothbard was a leading exponent, has never been more needed, nor has it ever been more relevant. Unfortunately, it's never been more likely to be ignored or even to be attacked as part of the problem rather than accepted at the heart of the solution. Coming to the end. I'd like to finish with just some reflections, these more personal perhaps than anything I've said before, on Christianity and freedom. With the exception of strict Calvinism, I don't know if there are any exponents left, there may be, and possibly some less than orthodox strands of Catholicism, such as Jansenism, Christianity by and large is committed to the belief that God is free, and so is man. Man is free metaphysically inasmuch as his actions, though conditioned by factors such as heredity, environment, training, education, association, and so on, are nevertheless not determined. Practically inasmuch as his actions are not constrained by factors outside himself. Now, for those of us who are Christians, we believe that man is created in the image and likeness of God. That likeness is most obviously manifest in our possession of intellect and will. Our capacity to grasp reality by means of our intellect is a dim reflection of God's creative knowledge, limited intrinsically by our finite nature. Our freedom, too, mirrors the divine freedom. Milton, in Paradise Lost, has God speak of man thus, "I formed them free, and free they must remain till they enthrall themselves. I else must change their nature and revoke the high decree, unchangeable, eternal, which ordained their freedom." So this really is a central Christian belief. For those of you who are theologically sophisticated, you might recall the theological controversies regarding the relationship of grace to freedom. There were five, maybe even more, schools of thought: Thomism, Augustinianism, Molinism, Congruism, and Syncretism. All of these various systems, however, respect the basic data founded upon scripture and tradition that God is omnipotent and that the human will remains free under the influence of efficacious grace, which is not irresistible. In fact, the disputes between the five schools got so bitter that in the end, the Pope told them all to shut up, right? Stop arguing among yourselves. Stop calling each other rude names. As long as you hold on to those two central data, any theory that's consistent with it is acceptable. Now, get on with the job. Freedom, then, is a constitutive element of man, both metaphysically in the indetermination of his will and practically in the non-limitation of his actions. I believe that God made us to know, love, and serve him in this life. I believe that God loves us with a love that is utterly disproportionate to our merits and that he wishes us to love him back in return. Why? It's a mystery. But that love must be a free response to his overtures. Even in the sphere of human actions, love to be love must be free and unconstrained. However much we want someone to love us, that love, is to be worth anything, must be freely given and not coerced. The burden of many fairy tales, operas, films, is that pseudo-love, produced by a magic potion or its latter-day technological equivalent, is no love at all. The desired end, the love of the beloved, has been attained only by the means of the very destruction of the beloved, which is what one wanted in the first place. God, who loves us in a measure that passes all understanding, will not force us to love him. In the end, he respects our choice, even if that choice is mysteriously to reject him. Here, then, is my key point, and I mean this with the... I know I've made some jokes today, but I mean this with the absolute... I'm absolutely serious on this. If God, who manifestly has the right to do with his creation what he will not coerce us, what creature can presume to take it upon himself so to do? I believe, therefore, that my religion is not only consistent with libertarianism, properly understood, but that in fact, and here I'm pushing the boat out a little, it actually entails it. All right? That should start some fights. Okay. So let me then finish. Given the commitment to liberty, then, that lies at the heart of my religious beliefs, and the commitment to the core truths of Austrian economics demanded by reflective rationality, if all truths are compossible, then there can be no fundamental conflict between my religion and my economics. There may be apparent conflicts, but I know a priori that those apparent conflicts are indeed apparent. As Rothbard recognized, some, perhaps many libertarians, are libertines. And libertinism is in conflict with my religious commitments. But libertinism is not a necessary consequence of libertarianism, any more than statism is a necessary consequence of religion. In reflecting then on the supposed quarrel between religion, the supposed quarrel between religion and science, to take an example from the past, is exemplified in the dispute between Galileo and the Church. It was said that religion teaches us how to go to heaven and not how the heavens go. So religion does not teach us how the heavens go, and it doesn't teach us how chemistry goes, or physics goes, or economics goes. That's not its job. Mark Twain once noted that rumors of his death had been greatly exaggerated, and we can say the same for the supposed quarrel between religion and economics, provided that that religion allows for the reality of human freedom. The quarrel between them has been much exaggerated. Thank you very much. So, if you have any questions, exhortations, expostulations. Yes.
What is it that Jesus said very good
for socialists? I'd have them read the Gospels again. Sorry, the question was, what would I say to people who say that Jesus is the first socialist? And I'd say, read the Gospels. I don't deal with it here, but I've written a short paper on this, and I went through and found all of the passages where Jesus talks about these things. I mean, there are all sorts of interesting things, like the parable of the talents. Anybody pay attention to that? Okay, so one guy gets five, one guy gets two, and one guy gets one, right? And the guy who gets five has to go off, and he turns up with another five. I hope I got it right, so you know, correct me if I'm wrong. And the guy who does two does likewise. And the guy who got one said, Master, I was afraid that I would lose the money, and I buried it. And here it is. You get it back just as you gave to me. And what does he do? He gets a pat on the back? No. He gets a kick up a certain part of his anatomy until he didn't do his job. Now, hang on a second. There's a presupposition in this parable, right? Which is, you got five talents? You better go use them. Don't let them sit there. Find some entrepreneurial activities and go make some money, right? How does that square with Jesus the socialist? Right? How about the parable of the workers in the vineyard? Right? Guy's coming on, he goes for the workers and he says, takes them on with crack of dawn, 6 o'clock in the morning, and says, I'll give you one denarius, one penny, and they say, great, we'll do that, and they work all day. And then he picks up some more people later on in the day and picks up some more, and then he goes, picks up some guys with just 1 hour to go. And they all turn up, and when the pay time comes, he pays the guys who came in last first. He gives them one denarius. So when the guys who were hired first come up, they think, that's great, we're going to get some more money. And they don't. And they complain. And then he says, it's my money. Did I cheat you? Did I break our agreement? Have I not a right to do with my own as I please? So, read the Gospels. Say to your friend, read the Gospels, yeah.
Since we're engaged in a more and more, let's ask these questions about what the Muslim is. Can you be a libertarian and a Muslim?
Again,
of course, does the worldview believe in a Muslim and individual liberty?
Okay, the question is in the context of terrorism, can you be a Muslim and be a libertarian? Is that correct? Okay. I'm not a Muslim. I can't speak with authority on this. But from the little I know, I'm told, okay, that, you know, just as in Christianity, there are very different views and very different understandings of what is required. Okay, so I once was at a conference in Switzerland, and there was a chap there from Morocco who gave a paper in French. Okay, which I was struggling to figure, okay. But I thought I understood most of it. And at the end of it, I said to him, I found that very interesting. Could you say those things in Morocco? And he said, no. And I said, well, come and talk to me when you can. So I don't know. It's a short answer to that question. I simply don't know. There are some people who say yes, and some people who say no. Some people think that Islamist is intrinsically connected in such a way that it leads necessarily to jihad, and others don't. But I can't comment. I couldn't really make a judgment on that. Yes?
How would you separate economism from Murray Rothbard's fusion of positive economics with normative ethics, natural rights, that kind of thing? So at what point does it become sort of too all-encompassing?
Well, okay, in Rothbard's case, it's quite clear that I mean, if you look, for example, in Power and Market and the chapter in there, what he's doing in there, the normative ethics doesn't come in there. When he wants to do that stuff, he waits until he gets to the ethics of liberty. And then he's quite clear about it. Okay, so it's an add-on. And so when he's talking about, even in the context of ethics, when he's talking about, he makes a clear distinction between the requirements of justice on the one hand and a fully developed ethical life. It's interesting, by the way, that this is actually what you find, despite the fact that Rothbard was extremely, extremely critical of Adam Smith, this is what you find in the theory of moral sentiments. This is Smith's idea in theory of moral sentiments. In other words, requirements of, think, justice are the things that are demanded of you by all, simply by virtue of your being human. They are things you may not deny to anyone and which you must require of everybody. Okay? But this is not the prescription for the ideal or the complete moral life. You can satisfy all the requirements of justice and be a miserable person. In other words, and no one can love you. You could effectively be a sort of Scrooge-like character and satisfy all the requirements of justice. So you have to be careful about that. So Rothbard clearly acknowledges that when he's talking, he's confining himself to this very limited sphere. And people persist in misunderstanding what he's doing and taking him to be talking about, if you like, the entire moral life. And he says, no, of course not. It doesn't make any sense. You know, please don't misunderstand me. Economism, I mean, so even Austrian economics could become economism if you took it, if you like, to be the answer to all of life's questions, to provide all of your ultimate values. And if that's what it was doing, then you will have problems between Austrian economics, thus understood, and your religious values. But as long as each of them, but again, but by the way, I mean, look, I mean, I'm a Catholic. I believe the Pope is infallible. Does that mean that if he thinks that, you know, Golden Girl is going to win the 230 at Newmarket, then I'm going to put my money on it? No. What do I look like? A fool? What? Okay, I mean, unless the Pope has been, you know, spotting racing form for a long time, and even then, I would think about it. His infallibility does not extend, you know, to the racing results. Okay, it extends to matters of faith and morals, not to economics, not to chemists. There is no Catholic chemistry, there is no Catholic physics, and there is no Catholic economics. I mean, this point seems to me sort of so blatantly obvious that I don't quite, when people sort of question, I don't quite understand what the argument might be. I mean, I've had all of these things. People say to me, how can you be a Catholic and hold all of these horrible libertarian views? And I go, well, I hold these horrible libertarian views actually because I am a Catholic, because I believe, as I said towards the end, that according to my faith, right at the heart of it, right at the very heart of it, is this mysterious freedom which is given to us, which extends right down to the extent that we can actually reject the ultimate gift which is offered to us. Remember, there is no such thing as a free lunch except salvation. Okay? That is actually completely and utterly free. That's probably why we're so suspicious. Okay. Here, take this. What's the cost? Nothing. And you go, ooh, I don't know. I think it's a bit dodgy to me. So, you know, you could have it, but happily, you don't have to do it. Okay. And for the most part, I don't know of any, maybe there are crazy Austrian economists out there. I'm sure there are. Okay. Who might, if you like, become economists in the sense in which I use it, but I don't know any. Okay. And if they are, we'll expel them. Yes. You're a wimp. Okay.
But my question is, I sort of have an answer to this in my head, but I want to hear your answer.
All right.
Do you think a Catholic can be a market anarchist?
Is this a trick question? Yes. Well, the short answer is I'm a Catholic and I'm a market anarchist, so at least in one person. Now, whether that doesn't answer the question whether it's coherent or not, I don't mean to be frivolous. No, there is, seriously, yes, I think so. I don't quite, I can't grasp the cogency, if you like, of any argument against that particular position. It seems to me that, look, one of the things I tend to get from my Catholic friends on this is you're being really sort of mean and you're, what about the preferential option for the poor and all the people? And I'm saying, look, do with your money as you will. Okay. And the example I always give, and sorry if it's a bit hackneyed, is this. And Grafton Street, by the way, is the main shopping street in Dublin. It's important to notice this for this story. Okay. So, Tom Woods and I are going down Grafton Street. And Tom, being a generous soul, there's somebody panhandling. And Tom reaches into his wallet and takes out, a 10-euro note and throws it into the guy's hat. And he says to me, Casey, don't be so mean. Come on, give something to the guy. And I go, no. Okay. And he goes, oh, come on. I mean, you know, he's obviously in need. And I go, no. And he says, I'll never speak to you again. And I say, don't tempt me. But he says, you know, I mean, I refuse to associate with you unless you do it. And he tries to persuade me and he tries to do all sorts of things to do it. And I say, no, 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 no. He can do all of those things. All of those are perfectly legitimate. The one thing he cannot do is reach into my pocket, take out my wallet, and take the 10 euros, put it there, right? No matter how deserving the cause, no matter how sound your judgment is on that, no matter how defective my understanding is, you cannot make those decisions for me. Okay, so if I'm a Christian, as I am, I believe I have an obligation, which extends well beyond the requirements of justice. But the way in which I satisfy that obligation is down to me. Okay? And in the end, the only one who can judge whether or not I have satisfied my religious requirements to look after those who are less well off than myself is not the state. It's not Tom Woods even, though I'd much rather Tom did it, okay? It's actually God. In the end, the only judge who will stand over me to ask me, in other words, to say, I was thirsty, did you give me to drink? I was hungry, did you give me to eat? And if the answer is yes, then I've satisfied my obligations. Nobody else can make that judgment. And that, of course, is what the state does. That is what the state does all the time. It says, there are all these poor people they need looking after. Here, take your money, and we'll do it for you. Now, apart from the fact that it's theft, which it is, right? It's also remarkably inefficient. A lot of the money seems to disappear before it ever comes out to the other end. Okay, so that's the utilitarian argument, but the principal argument is its theft. So the question is, can a Catholic be a market anarchist? Yes. I have not seen any argument to persuade me that there's any problem here, and I'm confident in expecting that I won't find any argument. And I actually did like your piece, as you know. Yes. Yes.
I think that's a pretty great word playing on the notion that the state sets itself up in the respect that it's God. What's happening bizarro to me, especially now, I mean, I've been a Christian all my life, but only a libertarian for, I guess, going on 5 or 6 years now. And what is absolutely bizarro to me is how Statesology has managed to entrench itself into the church. And I'm not a Catholic, but my experience in the Protestant church is such that this is, goes beyond to which I could possibly imagine before, even back when I was not a libertarian. So yeah. My question to you is, how then do we deal with this? These people who, in a sense, have two religions that they follow. And
it's a very good question. Part of me wants to say, I don't know, but I'll offer you some reasons. I'm often impressed when I go into Church of Ireland, which the Anglican Church in Ireland is called the Church of Ireland, and I sometimes go for various reasons, or in England. You look at all of the plaques on the walls to Colonel this and Colonel that and so on. It's a bit, and you think, am I in the wrong place? I'm always shocked, by the way, when I go into a church in this country and see the Stars and Stripes. Even in Ireland, you won't find the Irish flag up. It's quite striking. Okay, what everyone thinks about it, okay, and I'm not trying to denigrate the particular symbol and so on, it's just not the place for it. And on a Sunday morning, we often have prayers of the faithful, and some of them pray for our civil leaders, and I say, yeah, they need a lot of praying for, so do I, if it comes to that, but not for the reason you think, okay? Not to guide us and do all, but basically to go leave us alone. So I never say amen to that one, okay? I always opt out of that one. So, but can I come back to the main point? How entrenched the state-olatry is. It is absolutely amazing. I'm teaching several courses now. I've sort of come out of the closet as a libertarian and shocked all my colleagues and students. And they can't quite believe that I'm serious, but I am. And the protestations always begin with, but. Right, when I say something, and then you have something offered. It's so obvious. Like, what would you do about roads? What would you do about schools? What would you do about this? And I say, we have answers to all of these things. In fact, we had schools before we ever had the state doing it. We had roads. All of the roads were private. All the rails were private and so on. And they go, but. And of course, Rothbard's point, in most of his works is just that, in other words, the ideological, imprinting of this from the earliest age is so deep that even when you convince people by arguments, the kind of cobwebs that still remain allow it to remain in position. And so once they leave your baleful influence, okay, it reserts itself. They kind of go, oh, it's crazy. It's a sort of mental storm. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We've finished.